know him for his impeccable science and great reputation. Surely I jest, it is only me. Someone will help me keep time. Thank you. Okay, so today I want to talk to you a little bit about soil carbon and phosphorus responses to hydrologic management scenarios in Everglades restoration. And as you all know, Everglades restoration is a big program, and there's a lot of detail there, so buckle up. I'm going to try to touch the highlights as we go through. I would like to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Carl Fitz, who put together the EcoLand mod, or the model we used, Steve Davis from Everglades Foundation, Rex Ellis from the from the St. Johns River Water Management District, and Mike Ross from FIU. Okay, so what I'm going to present today comes from the synthesis project that I participated in as the soils guy that they needed, but the synthesis of Everglades Restoration and Ecosystem Services, or the SEERS project, was a large undertaking by many scientists in South Florida to try to bring us up to the current status of Everglades restoration and then assess in various different hydroecological responses in terms of what the Everglades will look like under different management plans. Now, the process took quite a few minds together. I'd like to acknowledge, I won't read all the names, but you know several of these folks. Some of us in this room work with them on a regular basis. The National Park Service funded this work, and that's the Everglades National Park. And what we were tasked to do was to look at a series of restoration alternatives, as they are. And when you're thinking about the Everglades and how to restore this ecosystem, those of you that are familiar with it know that it's no small task, right? By the numbers, the ecosystem that's remaining is rather large, 1.7 million hectares, thousands of kilometers of levees, multiple canals, pump stations, water control structures. There's a heavily engineered system that's left today. And one of our biggest problems, of course, is what to do with water and how to get water to the places that it needs and maybe get some of the water out of the places that we don't need it. Now, this is coming with an $11 billion price tag. And I know this is a talk or parts of a talk that I've given before, but that number still resonates to me as being gigantic, right? Now, hydrologic restoration is a monumental task in this system simply because of the level of engineering that we have now. And there's been several different programs that have gone toward reaching that goal. SERP, as well as DECOMP and SEP. I'll define those. The Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, or SERP, is the big price tag element. DECOMP, or the Decompartmentalization Project, is a form of that, or a smaller portion of SERP. And then the Central Everglades Protection Plan is yet another step back in terms of how we can potentially enact some of those restoration tools to get the end goal. Now, the history of the Everglades is well known, I think. A large ecosystem that has been altered for our benefit, for agricultural interest and flood control, and we're really good at doing that. So we were able to move that water out of the places we don't want, say Okeechobee floodplain area, and bring it through the Everglades and out to sea, in some cases lost to tide. But moving that water rapidly through the system has its effects, right? And as we see, and you'll see this picture or pictures similar to this, I'm sure, in other talks today, you'll see on Alan Wright, who is well known to many of you, standing beside the subsidence post in Belgrade, Florida. This is an effect of draining of those large organic soil areas, right? And this continues to be an issue today. You'll also see our Dr. Lynn Cento standing beside a building here. That's a while back, as I understand. I've been saying that's Lynn for years on this slide, but I was glad to actually find that out today, that I was not telling a fib. Now, along with all of that organic matter oxidation, as it were, or subsidence, we have all of the nutrients that are tied up in that material also leaving the system. And so, in effect, not only are we losing organic soils to the north of the ecosystem and shunting water through, but we're also taking quite a bit of the nutrients with it, specifically phosphorus. And I'm sure anybody that's heard an Everglades talk has heard about phosphorus in great detail. The thing I want to tell you is that from a perspective, from an ecological perspective, phosphorus can have some dramatic effects on the existing ecosystem as it is, right? To the right, you'll see an interior photo. This is a picture from the center of Water Conservation Area 2A, basically giving us a view of what we would think quasi-pristine Everglades would look like. Sawgrass-dominated marshes with open water sloughs, you know, the ridge slough ecosystem in the foreground. And then in a phosphorus-enriched area, such as near inflows, kind of a cattail or Typha domingensis-dominated ecosystem. And there's a change there. You say, well, you know, it's sawgrass, it's cattail, what's the big deal? They're both fixing carbon, they're both wetland plants. But the cattail ecosystem does not offer the same habitat value. Ecosystem services are diminished. The soils that are produced by this particular plant are also of what we would call lower quality in terms of their persistence. So our task in the Sears group was to look at a couple of different hydrologic scenarios. And what I'll start with is the dreaded scenario of no action. This is the existing condition base. This is what happens if we don't do anything else. I check it as a fail for those of you that can't see way back there. Can't let that happen, right? But to compare on this modeling exercise that we're going to do over a period of simulation of, say, 36 years, this is the scenario in which we don't really do anything. We just business as usual, right? And I think we're actually past that now. Some things have happened in the Everglades in the last year or two that kind of that push us past this restoration scenario. And then, of course, the antithesis of that is the restoration scenario that is the full restoration as planned under SIRP. Now, this is the $11 billion picture. Note, up in the corner, we're reducing phosphorus. This is not part of the other scenarios I'm going to tell you about, so that's a big thing to consider. But also, we're going to increase water flow from the Okeechobee Basin, and we're also going to decompartmentalize or remove hindrances to flow, i.e. canals and levees, through the system. That's what those little red hash marks are. So look at the size of the arrows you see coming through in terms of flow and removal of those levees. And then these last couple of scenarios kind of give you a in-between. Well, given the current climate we have for finances of these projects, we say, well, you know, if they have to reel back, what's this going to look like? So restoration scenario option C. Increased flow. You'll see a little bit of increased flow from the top, from current. And maybe we could get rid of a canal or two. That's the L67 for those of you that are familiar with the area. And somewhat increase flow through, minor removal of structures, but really no change to water quality. That's a really expensive part of the price tag. We call that partial restoration, right? Okay, so our next scenario is kind of option D. It's a little bit better. We're gonna improve water storage to the north, bring a little more water into the system. So that's a partially restored hydrology, removal of selected levees and canals, but still no change to water quality. This is termed the expanded storage and decompartmentalization scenario, similar to the decomp plan. All right, option E, and this is the last one, is a little bit better. We're going to maximize water storage in Okeechobee Basin. We're going to remove as many levees as we possibly can. But this is basically SERP without the water quality improvement, because that's still a heavy price tag. And so we utilized Carl Fitz's model, the ELM model, or the Eco-Land Mod, as he calls it. This Everglades landscape model is integrating quite a few different relationships. All right, so I think his model is currently the best that we have in South Florida. The South Florida water management model is on a much broader scale and maybe not as sensitive to some of the changes, but it integrates dynamic processes of a hydrology, biogeochemistry, and plant biology. And probably the most important nuance or difference between Carl's model and the other models that have been utilized to kind of predict changes in the Everglades would be the size of his landscape picture. So think of these little squares. The South Florida water model or management model is a 2 kilometer by 2 kilometer grid. In Carl's model, he runs multiple processes at a 500 meter grid scale. So 16 times better prediction power, at least from the perspective of the picture, right? and looks at this throughout the different types or landscape portions that he looks at. So, when we run this, we inform it with quite a few samples. There's a couple of points up there. A lot of data provided by Dan Scheidt and Peter Kalla from the REMAP effort. Several of you in here participated in that, as well as the Everglades Soil Mapping, a project I worked on years ago. Ramesh Reddy's the PI on that one, where we sampled 1,400 points across the Everglades. So pooling these, we end up with about 3,200 points. Those are used to inform Carl's model, present-day status, and then the simulation runs on a 36-year interval. So what do we get? Well, I had a 50-50 chance of getting this right, you know, when I put this in last night, so I should stand over there. But all I'm saying is we plug these into Excel, let it do its thing, and then we can all play until lunch. Carl's model runs for about 20 hours and spits out some really interesting observations. Hard to see from back there. It's a small screen, so I'm going to walk you through it. But what you're looking at is existing condition base, SERP 0, or the full implementation, and the change in color is the change between those two maps. All right? The blues are negatives, the browns are gains. And so this is surface water depth. To start out, we're losing the ponding effects in the northern conservation areas, which is a really important part of restoration, and we're gaining water in Everglades National Park to the south. Now, we focus more, not just on water, but on carbon and phosphorus, and so the model performance for phosphorus accumulation looks kind of similar, where we are gaining phosphorus accretion in some of these areas right now that are ponded and or very dry. That's partly due to hydration, right? And then we're losing phosphorus accumulation in some key areas like Short River Slough and the northern water conservation areas, where it's really dramatic. That shift in ecosystem expression that we looked at before is occurring. I want you to take a note that, as compared to SERP, the full implementation, that being zero, SERP to SERP comparison is zero, our target is less than 500 milligrams per kilogram of total phosphorus in soils. That's kind of the threshold that we establish for that shift to cattail dominance, and that's what we're trying to avoid. But in terms of performance, option E, interestingly, which is almost SERP, actually performs much worse than SERP or some of the other options. And that, again, is more water, but no change in water quality. So here we see how important water quality changes are. We have to bring that total phosphorus number down. When we look at peat accretion, another important aspect of Everglades restoration, and we want to reinvigorate those soil building processes, what we end up seeing is that, of course, again, this is brown, is accretion increase, blue is accretion decrease. We're losing a little bit of accretion down south and gaining it in areas to the north. Now, you say, wait a minute, that's kind of opposite of what we'd expect. Wouldn't we want to see accretion in the Everglades where we're losing soils tremendously and kind of a stabilization of accretion up north? But what that is an artifact of the phosphorus inputs. So, in fact, if we look at the numbers, the existing condition base, as of right now, actually performs better in terms of carbon accretion than SERP does. And this was an interesting finding. Once we turn off the phosphorus, we turn off more rapid productivity, right? So we had to make a trade-off as a group. We said, wait a minute, is that really what we want to see? And so we had to prioritize. And this is a hard thing to do, and especially if you spent a career working in the Everglades and wanting to see changes there. But so my take-home to you guys is that the SERP scenario outperformed all the others with respect to phosphorus. And that was the initial goal, to find out about accretion rates, right? But implementation would result in lower overall carbon sequestration, and that was a big head scratcher for us in terms of how do we prioritize these. Because this would, you know, maintain the soils, they would stay intact, and we would lessen subsidence with that implementation. Finally, though, we decided that maximizing habitat quality and soil quality over soil quantity was more ecologically valuable than just sheer carbon sequestration, even though that's a really popular thing right now under these scenarios. And so my final take-home is that long-term goals of ecosystem management in the Everglades should be conservation and enhancement of soil quality and not quantity. Okay, before I leave you, I want to plug a meeting that we're going to host here in Florida in April of 2018. This is the 12th International Wetland Biogeochemistry Symposium. As wetland soils or S10 division people, I'm hoping that you guys will all put in abstracts and join us for that. Do I have time for a question, moderator? Why, yes, you do. All right. One question really quick as I switch the slides. Anyone? Sit down sometime and, like, talk about making sure we gather data on those western transects that are going to match up with the kind of data collection you guys are doing, so it's like, you know, it's good data set, you know. Because he didn't give me a lot of direction. He's like, yeah, you know, soil phosphorus and some plants, and I'm like, paraffite. And I'm like, and now he's out. So it's like kind of open-ended, you know.
Everywhere we look at it, so the point that, you know, other people are going through on this, but the point is across the greater landscape, respiration, maybe productivity is, maybe production is phosphorus limited, but respiration is not phosphorus limited.
Right.
And that's kind of, you know, Amador Jones, those guys said that it was, and it doesn't seem to be, right? You can't seem to find, you know, phosphorus limited respiration once in a while. Like, Tassani, they wrote a paper. Designing the down to Taylor Slough, but way in the southern part of the Everglades where there is like some real phosphorus limitation, you know, 200 micrograms per gram of phosphorus, but not up in the fours and fives.
Right.
So across the system we don't see it, and then we certainly, so we thought we would use it in the northeast shore of Slough transect. We thought, you know, okay, the system, it'll be like not phosphorus limited, and then it'll be phosphorus limited as you get further away from the source. But even at 400 micrograms, in the peats, they're not phosphorus limited for respiration. The carbon is what reduces, you know, the availability of labile carbon is what seems to keep respiration.
Interesting.
So I don't think that's a really great. I don't know if we're going to keep doing that enzyme assay, because I'm not getting good results out of it, because I just don't think. And I can make good results out of it, if, you know, in an experimental setting, right? In a really phosphorus dependent system, but I don't think it's respiration is phosphorus limited.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, well, I see that.
We're gonna publish it. We're probably gonna, you know, people are screaming, but that'll be alright.
Well, that's okay. There's always someone screaming in an Everglades discussion, you know.
It was not my assumption. You know, I was expecting to see enzyme activity change along the gradient.
I'm really excited about this priming concept, though, about, you know, if labile carbon can crank up enzymatic production, and then that overwhelming activity then starts really getting after more recalcitrant carbon.
So we did get priming in this, and one of the reasons is probably it's an assay, so it's it's a 72 to 96 hour headspace incubation. Where people have seen priming is when they let these things go for a month.
Right?
And so
we got to burn up all the goodies first.
And we did. We had 1.2 millimole glucose, and I think we recovered like the most was like 0.4 to 0.8 millimole.
Okay.
So they were still respiring what we added.
Mm-hmm.
So the priming means, you know, you know what you use plus.
And then you get some more. Yeah.
Yeah. And we might have if we let them go a month, you know, which we may.
I kind of always, just having done respiration out there and done various experiments, assumed that, you know, the degradability of cattail soil would just be exponentially greater than sawgrass for several reasons. One, I always thought, well, it's low, you know, higher phosphorus and nitrogen, low C-to-N ratio, low C-to-P, you know, and then,
it's really kind of soupy.
And when you look at the soils that it's built on, you know, you say, wow, wow, it really isn't a lot there. I mean, it really does seem like it's probably just respiring away. You know, it'd be interesting if you guys didn't capture type of soils. Yeah, I mean, I saw the distribution of sites all over the place. I thought surely some of them came in there, but
No, because the one thing is the 65 sites that were pulled for that, and then the 25 that we used, we were restricted to. That would be a good thing because we were
like slough.
We were restricted to only clay-related places because that was part of a vegetation study. So in order to do those, the standing stocks, we had to have. You know, we had to have, they used cladium as the, and so that whole remap thing is based on cladium as the indicator of vegetation. It's kind of, it's cladium heavy. Right?
Cool.
Even when you were in, although Jenny did characterize at least maps of all these different mosaics, but when they looked at, at that level, there was, so this is sparse cladium, and really that's like a juncus prairie, right? In other words, it was a sparse cladium prairie. It wasn't a prairie, it was a sparse cladium prairie. So that's how they did it in this. That kind of was the vegetation people's goal.
What
did kind of work along with that?
How are Dan and Peter doing? I haven't seen those guys in a long time.
Good, actually. Yeah, I just, I haven't seen them. I talked to them, I talked to them on the phone like once a month. We just were putting all that remap and everything, kind of finishing all that up. So I've been on the phone with them quite a bit. Pete's fine. Dan's running around a lot. Dan seems to be like hectically busy and stuff. But both of them don't think that there's a problem with them. They're safe.
Okay, cool.
It may be hard for them to fund projects that they want to fund. They got the work that they're doing, and it's still too early to see if they're not going to get new projects. Like, remap might be, but we wouldn't be in a, so we're talking about this, and we weren't really in a, remap ends in, it's like 5 years. So they're not
over that 5 year period, it'll be
a
better climate to get things done. Oh, I gotcha.
I also
brought up the